two sources of internet protocol. Actually, there's probably even a third. I don't know if any of you got the notification I recently did that public libraries are offering open access. So in the worst case scenario, if something gets screwed up with your telecommunications or ISP provider, theoretically, you can go to a hotspot and pay your bills or deal with it there. But I realize that there is a problem at that point. As far as I'm aware, if you demand to pay by check, I don't think that they can deny you. They just prefer it the simple, easy, clean, and cheap approach.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
If you go the route that I was just mentioning, the most important bill that you pay is your telecom bill. Otherwise, your life is disrupted. It's not like going to the corner and buying a loaf of bread or a fresh loaf of bread when you want. You have got to make big changes. If you have a disruption with your telecom company because of the fact that whatever it is, whatever their dispute is or your dispute is with them, you have just isolated yourself if they cut your service. You're not paying your bills. So what comes down to is the most important bill you pay is your telecom bill. Because if you don't, you're going to have a rough time paying all your other bills.
Okay, George, I will give you that. Again, in my case, my cell phone is AT&T, and my ISP provider in my house is Fios. So it's too different. So I'd have to screw up two different providers in order to completely knock myself off of the internet. But it's still worst case scenario. I could travel a couple blocks to my public library when it's open, and apparently they have an open access Wi-Fi. Not the greatest solution, but a temporary one. Any other comments on this particular topic? Okay, I guess we did our job on that. Let me read you one of my little articles because it's quite interesting, I think, and appropriate to the overwhelming subject of this particular net. Researchers just saw a new distance record for 6G transmission. They got it all the way to the building next door. So the way the story goes is if you've ever wondered why you've been hearing about 5G for years, but the actual rollout has been glacially slow. Looking at the development of 6G, that's the next generation wireless standard, should provide some answers. Recently, LG announced a new milestone with a record-setting 6G wireless data transmission. Are we talking about an entire city? Nope, try the building next door. So back in June, it was Samsung that touted a new record for 6G wireless transmission using hardware. It was a 140 gigahertz transmitter. It was first developed at the University of California, Santa Barbara back in 2017. The researchers successfully transmitted data at a rate of around 775 megabytes every second. That's about 6.2 gigabits per second. Across a distance of about 50 feet. The speed limit before that, set by Nokia and Turkey's Turk Telecom back in March, had topped out at around 4.5 gigabits per second. Let me drop for a second. With this announcement, LG Electronics, which has been working with European Research Lab, didn't go into details about how much data was transmitted, but we know that 6G is going to be blazingly fast. That's a given because 6G signals will exist in the current unused terahertz spectrum past 100 gigahertz. 5G signals exist in a frequency range of up to 40 gigahertz and across a wider bandwidth of frequency, so there will be less wireless traffic to deal with. The problem with the terahertz frequencies that 6G will use is that they currently have a very limited range and tend to lose a lot of power when passing through antennas used for transmission and reception. Instead of simply adding even more cellular towers across the country to bridge the gap, the ideal solution is to find ways to increase the distance of 6G broadcast. LG worked with the Fraunhofer-Heinrich Hertz Institute and the Fraunhofer Institute for Applied Solid-State Physics to develop a new power amplifier, as well as an adaptive beam-forming technology that's used to better target and direct 1 gigahertz range from the Fraunhofer building to the Berlin Institute of Technology in Germany across a distance of 100 meters, and to you and me, that's 328 feet. That might not seem like a mind-blowing record given the two buildings are basically right next door to each other, but it's an important step to making the technology that will power 6G in practical environments and not just inside a tightly controlled lab environment. It also is important to remember that 6G standard hasn't even been finalized yet. That won't happen until 2025 at the earliest, with the technology possibly rolling out to the consumers by 2029 or 2030, which is an optimistic estimate given how the 5G rollout is still going. But it promises to bring us one step closer to ubiquitous wireless data connections everywhere, and finally saying goodbye to ISPs. Except your phone company will now be your ISP. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Snarky comment, WB2EAV.
Snark away as you wish, Ed.
The more technologically advanced and more available our communication is, the less people call me back.
Well, there's a whole bunch of different reasons for that type of activity. Young people don't even like to use phones anymore. I don't know if you have long-winded conversations with relatively younger people. They'll text you. They don't even like doing email anymore. So, you know, I know more than a few young people who have a phone and never seem to talk on it.
I am not talking about younger people.
Okay, well, what can I tell you? Some people are phone people and some people aren't.
No, I just find it amazing. We have better communication than we have in human history. And, like, for example now, if you apply for a job, they don't even bother to tell you you've been turned down. They leave you hanging.
I don't know. I tend to think that that's still rudeness. If anything, maybe rudeness has escalated in this modern day, but I don't know. I don't think it has anything to do with our technological prowess. I think it's just people don't really finesse the details anymore, leave people hanging, ghost people. It's incredibly easier these days to do things like that than in the old days, when you didn't have caller ID and the phone rang and it might be important, so you picked it up. And thankfully, it wasn't some guy in India telling you that the IRS is out to arrest you any minute. Okay, I thought 6G would interest some people. It's a brand new shiny example of technology, terahertz radio systems. Even microwavers, I don't think, are doing too much on the terahertz end, so it's really blue sky science. Something to look forward to in the future. Right now, I'm not quite sure whether we really need that amount of bandwidth, but nevertheless, we live in a world where if you can do it, or even if you can't do it, you really try hard to do it. So I wish them all well, and I hope it comes to fruition and doesn't make things worse. Okay, before I call an end to this segment, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. You guys make or break a net, a technical net or any other type of net. I do hope that some of you out there who have amateur radio questions will come and bring them to future TechNet so that we can talk about antennas and radios and all that fun stuff. You know, it can't all be lasers and ionizing radiation and such. So want to remind everyone, if you cannot reach us via the radio and you either want to ask a question or pose a topic for discussion, or offer a puzzle, or have me tap Paul on the shoulder. The email to reach me would be mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at my call sign, which is alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. And please, go to the link page. There are a bunch of different articles and a YouTube that you might find interesting. It'll be available 24/7 for the foreseeable future. You just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com. That'll bring you to that. And as always, I stream the Glen Oaks repeater on the internet. Just point your browser at technet.ac2gs.com, and you'll be able to hear that audio stream almost 24/7. I take it down a few times through the week just to reboot my system and such. And remember that Mike KC2NJI maintains a great archive of past TechNets that go as far back as September of 2006. They're a great source of material for a lot of smart amateur radio operators who unfortunately have become silent keys throughout the years. But their wisdom remains on those recordings, so avail yourself of it. So with all that in mind, once again, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight, and I hope that you all come back next Sunday at 8 o'clock, and maybe some of you will come with some amateur radio questions as well. And now it's time for Paul, WS2N, and the SpaceNet Report.
Okay, thanks, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N. And I'm glad we're doing the TechNet tonight, because I thought maybe if that hurricane acted up, we would be listening to a net for the purpose of the hurricane, which Limelight does, by the way. If there is a problem, they're very good at that. We've gone through a couple of storms, and it's a great service that Limelight does have if the power is knocked out. You know, where to get gas, where not to get gas, that type of thing. Anyway, I have one topic from last week I wanted to get to, but I did not do, and that was an up-and-coming launch. Since last week, they did launch. It was August 19th, which is last Thursday. And it was a sounding rocket. They launched sounding rockets from Wallops Island, Virginia. Sounding rockets are rockets that do suborbital flights. They don't go into orbit, and they do quite a few of them for either NASA, if NASA wants to run an experiment, or there's another bunch of sounding rockets that they launch in suborbital space for different colleges and universities. And this one, I think there was like 10 different universities that had experiments on this one. And they're launched on Orion Terrier rockets. They have a booster, and then they have a Terrier, which is a second stage. And they're always solid fuel rockets that they use. And they run different experiments. There's different ones where they'll release gas, and you'll get different colors. They'll examine the ionosphere by tracking, which way the colors are traveling. But this one was for, like I said, all these different students. They have three different versions of. They're actually called rock-on or rock-on launches. Rock-on is like the novice flights, where they would go to a lower altitude. The schools get into more advanced stuff that they'll want to go to maybe 60 or 70 mile height, maybe 20 miles high, and then the rock-on version. And that's called Rock-Sat-C. And then finally there's the Rock-Sat-X, which is the highest one, and that goes to almost 100 miles up, around 90, a little over 90 miles up. And they go out to the Atlantic Ocean, you know, it takes roughly 15 minutes or so for a complete launch. They go up and down on a parachute, they land in the Atlantic Ocean, and it's picked up by a ship. You know, they have a beacon on there so the ship knows where it is, it'll pick it up, and then the experiments will go back to the different universities that were involved, you know, like, could be used on sounding rockets. The college had space debris removal, different systems, different concepts, and they test all these things. You know, the satellites are, well, not the satellites, these things are, you know, run through the through this one, you know, through the 2-to-1 payload, usually around a couple hundred pounds total, and then it comes down on a parachute. So I thought I'd mention that, you know, they pick it up around 70 miles out from out at sea, so they have to have a boat out there ready to get it. Anyway, that was successful. They do this quite often, maybe about, you know, half a dozen times a year. And this one here, the 14,000-pound thrust one, which is the largest one, was the booster has a 18-inch diameter, which is the carrier booster, and the Orion second stage is around a little smaller, about 16 inches in diameter. The whole thing is around 40 feet long, a little over 40 feet long, and it's pretty good. They launch on a rail system. They have this rail that they're connected to, and they raise the rail up and light her off. And before COVID, a lot of the students would go, and they would, you know, they would actually be at Wallops. I think they're going to start doing that again. Maybe they did that with this launch to some degree. I don't know yet. So that's it on the student rocket that was launched on a suborbital flight on the sounding rockets. They call them sounding rockets. You ever hear sounding rockets? They don't clip to orbit. They're straight up and come right back down. Any comments? WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Okay, another thing I was going to cover is this crash of two satellites. You know, it's getting crowded in orbit up there. There are literally millions of pieces of stuff floating around. You know, things coming back down, but they keep sending stuff up. And then once in a while, once in a blue moon, I mean, around 10 years ago, this happened, but now it happened again, where you had a Russian satellite crash to a Chinese satellite. And I think it caused a breakup around, I think, 17 pieces. Now those 17 pieces will be flying around independently with more of a chance of hitting something else. And hopefully in time that, you know, they'll start to deorbit. But, this happening, like I said, in March, and we're only finding out about it last week. You know, they ran some experiments, they found out the satellite called the Yunhai 1-02 had crashed into a Russian satellite called Russian was a part of a spent booster. One of the Russian rockets is called the Zenit. Seen it, two rockets that they launched, and this one was launched in 1996, and it's been in orbit all that time. Sure enough, it collided. You can't keep these things apart, you know, if you keep sending more and more stuff up. So I'm a big fan of these companies that are developing systems to help deorbit things. They have they have some companies like that are in Japan that develop complete systems. One system is they have a net that's going to go around a satellite. Another one, they have like a harpoon, and they've tested that in space. This harpoon will penetrate the satellite, and then it'll be towed back down. All these different things. SpaceX is putting their satellites into an orbit where if they fail for any reason, they won't stay up forever. They'll start to decay, have a decaying orbit. But most, you know, if they find out that the satellite is really bad, they have Xeon. Krypton ion thrusters, which could lower the satellite, eventually start picking up air and deorbit that way. But something's got to be done. They do have, like I said, millions of pieces flying in space. You know, there's teeny tiny pieces. I think there's a couple hundred thousand pieces that are over 10 centimeters in, big, which that's around about 4 inches. So you have almost 200,000 pieces of stuff in that category. And then smaller stuff, it could be like a 3/8 nut or something, or a washer in the million category. Something gets hit with that at 17,500 miles an hour, you'll blow the other piece completely apart, or at least put a big hole in it. Go right through it. So I thought I'd bring that up, especially with more and more launches going up, especially with SpaceX and OneWeb. These companies are sending up broadband systems. They're starting off with, like SpaceX already has over 1,600 of them. They plan on getting up to at least 4,000, and then they plan on going beyond that to around 30 or 40,000 in the future. This has to be controlled, and who knows where it's going to end, because other companies are involved as well that are doing the same thing from other countries. China wants to do it. European Space Agency, they want to all send up broadband satellites. System could involve thousands of satellites, and not all in the same inclination. Maybe 10 or 16 different inclinations. Some polar, some equatorial, and everything in between. Not a good situation. Any comments? WS2M. Okay, in the news recently, we covered it on the net, was the launch of New Shepard. New Shepard is the one that is being launched by Blue Origin. They've launched a dozen of these things so far, different versions of it. I think they're up to the fourth New Shepard, which is a booster and a spacecraft put on top of it. It's all called New Shepard. Anyway, the last one that went up took Jeff Bezos, his brother, an old lady that's like 82 years old, and a young kid around 18 years old. Four of them went up and spent a total of maybe a 20-minute flight going up and eventually coming back down. They plan on charging, a couple $100,000 each. And I thought they were going to start doing this, but they're going to wait. The next flight that's going up, I think within about a month or so, is going to be unmanned. All science experiments, which Blue Origin gets paid for. It's just going to have experiments on board. They call that one NS-17. So, it's the last one. It's the 16th flight. This will be the 17th flight of New Shepard. And that'll be launching, I think, next month or so. But, they'll take experiments from everybody. NASA has already done it, giving them experiments to send up. And they'll take them from anybody. Maybe a dozen experiments on one launch and money for it. Not that Origin needs the money. It's run by the richest guy in the world, Jeff Bezos. But that's the plan, and then eventually after that, they plan on launching, you know, maybe, they say six people at a time. I think it looked a little cramped. They sent up four last time, and I think that's funny. Can't see doing six. You know, they unbuckle their seat belts, and they start floating around for a couple of minutes of zero G before they buckle up and come back in for a parachute landing. It looked pretty tight with four people. Any comments or questions? WS2S. We got a Dragon 23, the 23rd version of, not 23rd trip of a cargo vehicle going up to the International Space Station. And that should be launched this coming Saturday. And that's got all kinds of equipment, maybe 7,000 pounds worth of stuff, I think just under that, going to the International Space Station. They have equipment for the space station, such as, I think this is what's going to have another solar array. They call it ROSA, R-O-S-A, Rollout Solar Array, in the trunk. And, you know, similar to the last mission that went up. Actually, there'll be a total of six solar arrays that they need to install on the space station. And they roll out, and they're probably 150 feet long and 10 foot wide. And they're going to supplement the amount of power that the International Space Station gets. Last one was a success. Astronauts first did a couple of EVAs, and they installed all the brackets and everything that's necessary, and then eventually they do another EVA, and they'll take the robotic arm will take the ROSA solar panel out of the back of the trunk of the Dragon cargo vehicle, and put it into a position where the astronauts could actually install it onto the brackets that they'll be putting up. And so they have an EVA coming up soon to install the brackets on the next ROSA solar array project. But this launch, they have some scientific experiments that are going up. They have a retina diagnostic test gadget, relatively on a small size. Normally when you go to an eye doctor, they give you a test, and you want to test your retina, they have this big, pretty big setup that's all bulbous to the floor. They roll it in front of your eyes, and, you know, they can see whether or not you got macular degeneration or something. And then with this, it's a small, almost like a gun size type of gadget, and they need it because the astronauts' eyes tend to change. I think they said like 70% of the astronauts experience this. They go up into zero G, and the next thing you know, they have this ocular change, and they're always constantly testing their eyes. They have different glasses that are sent up in case that does happen. They start wearing the glasses in space because they go up for some, you know, a lot of times, six months at a time, or, you know, in the case of a couple of people, they've gone almost a year. But, you know, because this does happen on longer flights, when they start going back to the moon, or especially to Mars, you know, for months on end, you know, maybe 6 to 8 months to get the Mars. Last thing you need to do is have bad vision when you're trying to land a spacecraft on Mars after flying from Earth to that planet. So they need a gadget to test your eyes and make sure you're okay. And the good thing about this, they said, is if it all works on this experiment, you know, after they finish using it, they could actually convert this to for use on Earth, not that the eye doctors, that's not going to change anytime soon, but, you might want to, some of these eye doctors go to different foreign countries. They might want to test people in the middle of nowhere somewhere, and they'll have this portable device. What happens is they get this, they call it SANS, S-A-N-S, and it's in space anyway, and it's called the Space-Associated Neuro-Ocular Syndrome. Apparently this is going to look for that in case it's happening. So I'm not sure exactly what it's looking at, but they're going to be able to take it, put it up against somebody's eyes and experiment with it, see what it looks like. And there's all kinds of digital information that's going to be sent back to the ground as they're doing this. Let me drop it. One of the gadgets, I guess this is going to be in the trunk of Dragon. I haven't figured out that way. By the way, I say the word trunk. It looks like the service module, the back part of the Dragon when it goes up. In fact, when Dragon comes back, right before it enters the atmosphere, the trunk separates from the Dragon spacecraft, and that exposes the heat shield, and that's how the astronauts come back. They don't bring the trunk back with them. But in the trunk, on the way up, they always have pieces of equipment to bring to the space station. And in this case, they're bringing something up by NanoRack. It's a robotic arm. It's relatively small. When I say small, it's not a 57-foot robotic arm that the space station uses now. But this thing is, maybe a little bit bigger than a human arm. All kinds of joints on it. They're going to put it into the spaceship module. The spaceship module is attached to the tranquility module on one of the ends of the tranquility module. And the idea of spaceship is to, they could open that thing up and bring something very large into the space station or out of the space station if they need be. Send something, through the doors, which are only 52 inches big, is lost when you send up a crew vehicle. The only door coming through is about 1 meter, a little over, like 39 inches in diameter. So you need something bigger, and they use the Bishop door, let's call it. It's attached to one of the modules to bring anything big or large in, and I guess it's big enough to qualify. There's a robotic arm. I saw a video on it. I'll have to go back and look for it. Maybe I'll find it, put it on Dr. Roy's website maybe next week if I get a chance. But this arm, the dexterity on it is incredible. They showed it, as a demonstration thing, taking bolts out of this thing and putting the bolt down and then doing other things, opening covers. It's it'll be an extremely useful tool if this is developed by NanoRack. Their ultimate goal is not only to be able to do something on the space station, but eventually outside the space station. You could attach this to, the robotic arm, system, and then you could send it over to some thing that needs to be done. If there's an ammonia leak, which they have had on the International Space Station before, which involves sometimes pulling the covering off or moving the valves to the open and closed position. They have these valves that they could do that. This thing would be perfect for that type of thing. Like I said, it could take out bolts, put bolts in. That's going up as an experiment on cargo number 23 by SpaceX on the Dragon vehicle. So looking for, forward to seeing that. I'm sure they'll show that on the NASA site when they test that robotic arm out. So, okay, another topic I've been talking about in the last couple of months is the HLS system, the human landing system. That will eventually need some kind of a rocket that's going to be able to land on the moon. They have all these other pieces in place. They have the launch vehicle, which is the SLS, consisting of four essentially used engines from the shuttle era, the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, RS-25 engines. They're going to launch the space launch system, which would be 10.6 million pounds of thrust with a couple of gigantic solid boosters attached to it, and that will launch the Orion spacecraft to the moon with, say, four people on it. So they have that end of it covered. The other end of it, it will be the Gateway system, the Gateway space station that will be going around the moon. They have funding for that. They're plan on sending a propulsion module up, PPE, they call it power propulsion module. What they call it, the power impulsion, the power propulsion element, or basically a module that will do that around the moon, and that will be attached to a habitat module. Both of them are funded and under development now. And so you'll have Orion docking with that, which will be going around the moon, and then you'll have to be able to send a vehicle down to the moon. That's the HLS system, the human landing system. Which up until last week was being funded. NASA had given SpaceX a contract to develop a rocket or, a spacecraft that would be able to undock from the Gateway space station going around the moon and land on the moon and eventually relaunch and then go back and dock with the Gateway space station. And right now, I forgot how many millions of dollars was allocated for this, $100 million or something, whatever it is. They were going to fund SpaceX to develop it. A month or so ago, Blue Origin wasn't happy. They had a landing system as well that they were developing. And they were told originally that there was going to be two choices, two companies chose. And there were actually three that were competing for this: SpaceX, Blue Origin with their lander, and Dynetics with their lander. And, three good proposals. But NASA realized we're a little short of money here. And, we weren't given extra money to have two companies. We can't pay for two. So they stuck their neck out and they chose one, SpaceX. Blue Origin was not happy about this, either with Dynetics. So they basically complained to NASA they were able to do that. And that went before, I think, some kind of a, what do you call them, IG, Inspector General type of thing. They were able to muddy through the paperwork, and they came up with an answer for Blue Origin. You're out, SpaceX is in. So the contract, was stopped for that time period, a short period of time. And then it restarted again. Okay, let's continue paying SpaceX to develop the human landing system. So, you think everything's done and finished. Blue Origin comes in and they decide to sue. They're going to sue, NASA or somebody. They're suing somebody for this. It's going to go to the courts, and some judge or multiple judges will eventually make a decision on whether or not this is a proper decision by NASA. I kind of go, personally, I go with two contractors for everything, two separate contractors. Because if one fails for any reason, you have a backup, and your backup isn't identical to the one that failed. You know, you don't want to send something down to the moon, surface of the moon, find out there's something wrong with their system, and now you can't get them back up. You don't want to send down an identical rocket that just landed with the same problem. You know, instead of having four people trapped on the moon, now you got eight. You'd rather send down another completely different lander with a different contractor. So I'm in favor of that. The problem is the money wasn't there. So Bill Nelson is the NASA administrator. And, you know, he's got a partial solution for this. Right now, you know, the contract is stopped. They're going to wait for it to go through the courts. And but one of the ways out would be taking some of this trillion-dollar money that's supposed to be used for, you know, roads and bridges and highways and railroads. And all NASA needs is, you know, I think it's another, I don't know, $4 to $10 billion. Anyway, Bill Nelson is hoping to get funded from that, from the government, maybe with the infrastructure package to help fund an additional maybe $4 billion or so. See, NASA gets around $21 billion a year to do everything. You know, that's, you know, everything from, you know, their satellite work to supporting the International Space Station to new development of the Space Launch System. On and on and on, maintenance of all their buildings. But they have to make do with their $21 billion. So if they can get some more money out of this new infrastructure project, then NASA would be good to go. They would be able to choose their two contractors to do it. We don't know who they would be. We definitely know SpaceX would be one of them. But maybe Blue Origin with their lander, they call it Blue Moon Lander, by the way. Maybe they would be chosen. Maybe it would be Dynetics. I don't know. You know, they both had competitive landers. But hopefully it goes that way, and I don't know, I have a funny feeling that we'll go that way down the road, but that's only a guess now. I might be proven wrong, you know, 6 months from now. Any comments or questions? WS2N.
PB2BX,
Belport. Good evening, Frank. How are you? And over to you, WB2BX,
Yeah, very good. I just thought I'd put my 2 cents in here about the bid protest. The agency that handles bid protests is an outfit called the U.S. Government Accountability Office, once called the General Accounting Office, which is actually an agency of Congress. It's not an executive agency. And the office within the GAO that handles that is the Office of General Counsel, which is actually kind of unusual from what GAO does, and interesting from the point of view of everything that's going on now is GAO, right up to the head of the agency now, is entirely, to the best of my knowledge, career federal employees. I don't think there are any political appointees in the agency now. Well, Gene Dodaro, the head, is technically a political appointee, but he's actually been there his entire career. So it's a very interesting organization. I worked there for about 15 years before they downsized their field organization. Go ahead.
That's it, GAO. Okay, GAO. I'm thinking about the other group, which, you know, these inspector general groups. I'm thinking maybe that was it, GAO. Okay, very good. Yeah, that's hard to follow for me. I know they went up against I guess NASA, you know, and the first time around was through the GAO group, because this next one, because now, like I said, that stopped the contract with SpaceX. Now it's restarted again, but now they, you know, when I say they, Blue Origin, actually file a lawsuit. Now, that's a different group, am I right? In other words, it's just going to go to court. It's just going to be lawyers fighting, I'm assuming. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, well, the General Counsel's Office, the GAO, is the organization that does the bid protests, rather than the accountants, auditors, and economists that do the rest of the GAO's work. But, yeah, the way it works, if I remember correctly, from my training there years ago, is the bid protests, the General Counsel rules on them as the contractors have the right to appeal to federal court. And I have no idea how often that happens. And I believe what I've heard on the various YouTubes, Scott Manley and Everyday Astronaut and all those guys, is that what's expected to happen is that Congress will eventually appropriate enough money for a second contract regardless. That seems to be the implication of what's going to eventually happen. So I think you're right on that one. And the GAO, by the way, had a lot to say in setting up the IG organization. So GAO is sort of a super inspector general. Every federal agency has an inspector general's office, which is funded separate from the home federal agency. I think it's called a super appropriation or something. Like I said, I did this work many years ago. Hard to believe I'm old enough to say that. But anyway, yeah, so there is a relationship between GAO and the Inspector General's office because the GAO set up the IG system and sets the standards for them. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks, Frank. I'm conflating the two, the IG and the GAO. I'm thinking it's all one. But I gotta believe that this $1 trillion package will eventually start to go through. I don't know how long it's gonna take. That's all tied up in Congress. But whenever that goes through, I wouldn't be surprised if NASA gets enough money to get their two contractors. Otherwise, we're not going to be landing anywhere on the moon, that's for sure. Maybe 2028, because they're funded every year, another $20 billion next year, another $21 billion next year. And that's what NASA does. They'll take that, part of that money and put it towards, spacesuits. By the way, there's a problem with spacesuits. I think you probably read that as well, Frank. But, they have 27 different contractors, trying to make one type of spacesuit. So now that's been in the news. They're saying, oh, that's the problem. Yeah, I think that's the problem maybe for a year or so, but not the main problem. The main problem is they don't want to land. If I was NASA, I wouldn't want to land a crew on the moon nowadays without a backup vehicle. And a different one than the one that's landing. Let me drop it for any other comments. WS2N. Okay, very good. Thanks for the information, Frank. I appreciate that. Let's see. Did I talk about China? No, I didn't. I didn't talk about the another EVA. That's done by their astronauts. They're officially called taconauts, begins with a T, but let's call them astronauts. They have three astronauts on board their Pangong space station, which was launched a couple of months ago. And this crew has been up there almost 2 months. They plan on being there for a total of 3 months and eventually being replaced by another crew. On their spaceship, their spaceship is called the Shenzhou. Shenzhou what brings them up to their space station. They did another EVA last week, successfully. They're like us, they'll send two people out. They always send two people out. One guy is on the inside. They have their own robotic arms, you know. They really copy things that that we do. They have their own robotic arm, and they attach an astronaut to it so that they can more easily do work on the outside of the space station. They're setting the space station up for a number of things. They need basic handrails, first of all. You know, as you go along the space station, you hand walk from place to place. And they're also setting up power and data cables eventually to accept two more modules. This module that they have up there is similar to what the Russians would send up. This thing's about 50 feet long, 16 feet in diameter. And this is where they're living right now. But they're going to send up two more modules, probably about just as big. Next year, early next year, will be the next launch. Well, I read, I think early 2022 will be the next module that they send up, and eventually another one. So eventually you'll have a T-shaped system that they'll be using for their space station. Three big modules. And they have the capability of sending the equivalent of Progress vehicles, which Russians have, except these are a little bit bigger. They can send up more cargo, Progress, you know, cargo vehicle that autonomously docks with their space station to restock it with food and equipment, science experiments, and all of that. So they're duplicating what we're doing, which is they're really space program. And they're running around right now on two different surfaces outside of Earth, one on the moon. They'll have a rover riding around on the moon, and they have a rover presently riding around on Mars. So they're doing quite well. And I'll say something about the EVA, but it went out of my head. Anyway, they're continuing along. It's a different inclination. They're around 40, 41 degrees inclination. The International Space Station is 51.6.
Nap time complete.
There's no chance of one going near the other. I remember what I was going to say. One of the launches that they're going to do, I think, next year, is a Hubble-sized telescope. Instead of sending it into an independent orbit like Hubble is, we no longer could reach it. We used to be able to reach it with the space shuttle, but no longer. They're sending their Hubble-type spacecraft to in the exact same orbit, 40-some-odd degree orbit that their space station is in. This way, if there is a problem with their Hubble version of a space telescope, they'll be able to actually send a crew right over there. I think they have the capability of docking it with their space station. I'm not sure about that, but I think that's part of their plan. So they're really on top of it. Any questions or comments? Look at the time. Usually, when I shut down around this time. We'll do that if nobody else has any questions. This is WS2N for the Space Net Report of the Tech Net. Good evening, Sam. Sorry we sent that hurricane over to you. Hope you're okay over there. Probably got a lot of rain. Back to you, Sam. KC1SAM, WS2N.
Yeah, it landed about 40 miles east of me, and a lot of rain, got my antennas washed off real good up in the trees, so no problem with the weather, almost an event. I was curious, did you ever find that sample that they tried to put into that returnable test tube on Mars? There was nothing there when they went to look for it. I forget exactly what they called it, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, as of a couple of days ago, think it's about 3 days ago, I read that, no, they have not located yet. They tend to believe it was just pulverized. They thought they were drilling a core, and it was just pulverized. They're still investigating. You know, they want to know what the story is before they continue on. You know, I mean, well, you probably read it. It's all automatic, you know. Rover, Perseverance, robotic arm, drills a core three and three quarters inches deep, or maybe three quarters of an inch in diameter. It's supposed to take the core out, put it into a sample tube, which, you know, as far as they know, I mean, that procedure proceeded, and then they put it into this carriage. It's going to eventually have over 30 of these tubes in it. They put it in, and then they have a probe that's supposed to probe it before they put the cap on to see how much stuff is in there. And as you all know, Sam, the next to the robot now. You know, where's the sample piece? So as far as I know, they haven't found it, and I'm sure they'll make a decision on drilling into probably some other kind of rock. I think something that they already know is, a type of rock that they can drill into. They'll probably do that as a test. That's my guess of what will happen next time. And we'll see how that goes. So, without this being confirmed and being able to do this, you could hold up two space launches from Earth to go to Mars that are being planned and funded as we speak. European Space Agency is going to have an orbital spacecraft going around Mars, and that's going to accept all these test tubes that are coming from the surface that will be launched on a solid fueled rocket from Mars that is being developed by Northrop Grumman, and that has to get to Mars in the first place. So that's going to have its own separate launcher. So it's two separate launches. These are multi-billion-dollar projects that could be held up if they don't figure out what happened to the sample that you're talking about. Sam, KC1SAM, WS.
Yeah, familiar with the system. And there is so many ways things can go wrong. It's so complicated, but hey, you know, not for me to say. But I wonder, I just thought it was very funny that they couldn't find it. Like, you know, taking pictures, looking all over the place. I remember you said last week, I think, that it was probably, whatever. Anyway, shoot, I'll try again. I'm just curious if there's anything new on that. At least if that's what it was, they know it. You know, it's worse if you don't know what happened to it. All right, Paul, thank you. Casey, one of them. Back over to you.
Okay, Sam. Yeah, well, NASA has this problem. They lost their sample. They haven't had too many problems lately. But Russia has been giving them problems with the out of control thrusters on the Nauka module that they sent up. You know, these are major problems that they have. Of course, it affects NASA, but you know, affects the whole space station. The whole thing did a 1.5 flip, 540 degrees, and they had to go another 180 degrees to straighten it all out again and get it back to its proper orientation. To hold its proper attitude as it goes around Earth. You know, I mean, that's a serious problem. Or the hole in the Russian spacecraft a year or so ago.
JD2 SCP break.
I heard SET. Back to you. This is Paul WS.
JD2 SCP. The name is Lou. I'm in Yonkers, New York. I got a Wolfsham quad four-band radio I'm testing out. Just did a lot of programming. Over.
Okay, Lou, you're doing good. Whatever you did, you did right. So, good to hear you. audio sounds good. You know, it's you know, what kind of an antenna you got hooked up to this?
I'm actually using an old diamond scanner antenna, and this only puts out about 40 watts.